Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of May, Memorial Day in this country. We're going to be talking about girls and boys in education. The American Association of University Women released a report last Tuesday titled Where the Girls Are, the Facts About Gender Equity in Education. And it looks at educational achievement by gender, race, ethnicity, and income. The report shows that girls and boys from the fourth grade through the end of college are making steady educational gains. They did an analysis of all 50 states showing that girls' successes do not come at the expense of boys. This report is also the first to analyze gender differences within economic and ethnic categories, and it shows that family income is more closely associated with academic success than with gender. In states where girls do well on standardized tests, so do boys. On the other hand, in states where girls do not do well on standardized tests, neither do boys. We'll be talking about the detailed findings of this study, and our guest is Michael Olnick, who is professor of educational policy studies and sociology at the University of Wisconsin. Our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Michael Olnick, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
So as you look at this report, would you agree that girls' gains have not come at boys' expense?
I would agree with that. Certainly that the boys are not going down as the girls are coming up. I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. I don't think the gains are very strong for either group. And in a lot of years, there aren't many gains to speak of anyway.
Mm-hmm. And yet, the report does show that girls have been graduating from high school and college at a higher rate than boys. Much higher rate? And why higher at all? Just because there are more girls?
It's not really a much higher rate. It depends on what race and ethnicity we're looking at. White women are completing college almost 40%, whereas about a third of the white men are. Black women, 15% finish a BA, whereas only 9% of the Latino females, and 9% of the men among blacks. It's 20% of the females, but also 18% of the males. So that's not much of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think my main explanation would be that women gain more from their college education economically than men do. That is, the difference between a college graduate and a high school graduate is greater for the women than it is for the males. So there's that incentive. Another way of saying it is that white men particularly, but men in general, experience less discrimination in the labor market for people who have only graduated high school or not finished high school. It's always been the case that groups that experience more discrimination in the labor market are going to try to hedge against that by getting more education.
Mm-hmm. What about the reports, though, that AAUW gives us regularly that show that isn't this among college graduates, that female graduates are hired at a lower level, and then 10 years later, it's even a lower level?
That's quite right. What that doesn't point out, though, is that the incremental gain experienced by the women is greater than the incremental gain than is experienced by the men. So it's quite true. For example, I just looked at the latest AAUW report on Behind the Pay Gap. And 10 years out among college graduates, women are earning only 69 cents on the dollar. If you went and compared their earnings to high school graduate earnings, there'd be a bigger difference than there would be for men. So it's quite accurate that they don't attain the level that men attain, but they gain more relative to other women by continuing in school.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the part of the report that shows that there really are fairly significant disparities when you look at white students and when you look at African-American students.
That, to me, is the most important part of the report. I have to say it's long overdue.
Mm-hmm.
We've known about these enormous disparities for decades. They were certainly evident when the AAUW report, Shortchanging Girls, came out in 1992. In my judgment, the hullabaloo over women's achievement has been way overdrawn for decades. And so what the report is doing, I think, is simply stating what has been right in front of us, as I say, for a very, very long time. And those gaps are just enormous. You have, for example, roughly speaking, eighth grade African-American boys are reading at the same level as white sixth graders.
Mm.
I just mentioned the graduation rates from college. You have, a third to 40% of whites finishing 4 years of college, where you have maybe 20% of African Americans, and you have 10 to 15% of Latinos. These, to me, are of far greater import than any very modest differences in the achievement of females compared to males.
So the obvious question is why?
Why what?
Why do we have such a huge disparity?
We have a huge disparity for many, many reasons that add together or even multiply together. We have the fact that minority kids, that is particularly African Americans, are coming into school already well behind where white kids are entering school as far as the academic skills, knowing their letters, knowing their numbers, things that they are going to depend on the schools to teach them. Many other kids are coming in already knowing, already able to do the things the teachers want them to do. And in short, they're more ready to go given the expectations of the schools and how they approach kids. Then as you go on in time, I should say, it sounds like I'm blaming the schools, much of the growth in the disparity by race and ethnicity actually comes during the summers.
Really?
If the world were a endless summer, which some kids dream of.
Right.
If the world was an endless summer, the disparities in achievement by race would be far greater than they are. However, less effective than we want them to be in today's world, the schools we have are doing a real job by preventing the disparities from being far larger than they would be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important also, though, to say that really good, close, effective relationships between teachers and students of color are not easily established. Teachers are often working under conditions that make it impossible for them to take the time to really get to know the kids, to take the time to get to know the communities the kids come from, to connect with parents, to do a lot of the extra things that really are necessary to do for kids in communities that are not providing them with the resources that other communities are.
Mm-hmm. And money seems to play a factor here. Is this just because we get better schools the more money that we have? A rise in family income, the report shows, is associated with a rise in test scores.
I think at the extremes, the differentials in how much money we spend on schools can really matter. If you take a place like Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and you compare it to inner city Detroit, I don't actually know the exact difference in how much they spend per kid, but differences in expenditures that are very large do make a difference. Jonathan Kozol wrote a book called Savage Inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often cited as the evidence for why money does matter. What he did was he compared the worst of New York schools or the worst of St. Louis schools, the worst of Chicago schools, to the very best in those cities or those metropolitan areas. And to be sure, those kind of differences matter. But the average black kid or the average poor kid is not going to a school that spends that much more, if any more, than the school the average white kid is going to.
Mm-hmm.
So the issues become how costly is it to educate particular kinds of kids, given all the burdens of the city and poverty.
Right.
The question also becomes what you're doing with the money. Whether you're spending it in ways that actually are producing more constructive relationships between kids and teachers. So I don't think it's all about money. The correlation you mentioned between family income and how kids do is not just a result of people having more money. It's a matter of what they're able to provide their kids with through that money. It's also a question of the kind of cultural resources people who have higher status occupations or earn more money already bring to the table. They bring it to the table in their, when they go to their jobs, and they bring it to the table when they raise their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter simply, say, of if only we raised people's income by $5,000, say, through a negative income tax, we would expect to find a sudden jump in kids' achievement.
Mm-hmm. How important is it? Is it more important than ever, and if so, in what ways, to graduate from college for all students who are graduating from high school?
It's becoming more and more important. The more other people go further in school, the more important it is for any one individual to go, because they're being left further behind.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of the labor market as a long employment line and think about the distance between people on that line, if more and more people are going to college and you're standing still with a high school diploma, you're further behind in line. That is, some people may have passed you. And secondly, the distance between you and the next person is even further.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the premium to college has been rising. I would say, and it's important to appreciate, and it's something I didn't realize until I looked at some data more closely a couple of years ago, graduating from high school, and more importantly, learning something in high school, matters a lot. The kids who are scoring higher on tests, the standardized tests,
mm-hmm.
The kids who score higher on those tests tend to be employed more, they tend to earn more, and this is true even when the gains come among folks whose initial scores were pretty low. I'm saying this because I think sometimes people who are so focused on getting kids through high school and then on to college may forget that there's important work to be done for the kids who aren't going to go to college.
Right. And that's a lot when you just cited the number who graduated from college. That's a lot of kids.
It is a lot of kids, and it's increasingly large. And then the number of folks who are going on to get further degrees is large.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, you know, inflation. if we print a lot of money, it's going to be worth less. Well, if we hand out a lot of degrees, they're going to be worth less, all else constant. Now, it's never all else constant. Maybe people are really learning a lot in college, in community colleges, for example. And then maybe there will be the demand to reward them for that. But in the short run, more diplomas just means more of a race to stay in place.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee. It's 414-227-2050. Professor Michael Olnick, Professor of Educational Policy Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin, is our guest. And we're looking at the report that was released last Tuesday by the American Association of University Women. It is a very comprehensive analysis on trends in educational achievement by gender, race, ethnicity, and income. It shows that girls and boys in the fourth through the end of college are making steady educational gains. And the report indicates that girls' successes do not come at the expense of boys. This is looking at gender differences within economic and ethnic categories, and it shows the family income much more closely associated with academic success than with gender. Phone calls for our guest in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now, starting with Sari from Milwaukee. Hi, Sari.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an MPS teacher, and I teach in an elementary school. I've taught K-4 the last 3 years and K-5 this year. And this is a very important topic. Right now, I returned to education, teaching, in 2001. I taught in the early 70s, so I'm a product of living through the 50s and 60s. And at that time, education was valued. I'm African American, and you could be poor, we were poor, but education was valued, and education meant it was a key to success. It was a key to getting a decent job. Today, what I think I see is that, yes, you're seeing that there are African Americans who are completing, and the ones that are completing, the middle class, or those children from poverty who education was valued. Right now in the school systems, we are struggling to get parents interested in coming in and doing things with their children. It has a lot to do with their understanding of what education is right now. And I just see that the income of the families we have, they're struggling just to stay, you know, to survive, to make it through the day. And I just think that their understanding of what an education means isn't the same as what it was years ago, and what that means as far as success in a job.
Professor Olnick?
Before I say anything, I would like to ask the caller, what grade is she teaching in?
I'm K-5 right now. I've taught third grade in MPS, and I've taught sixth grade in MPS.
Uh-huh. The reason I ask is that some of the research that may be relevant to what the caller has in mind shows that problems of what appear to be caring or not caring in school by kids really become more pronounced as the kids get older.
Yes.
That aside, I think I would ask that the people who are teaching not assume that because it's difficult to get parents involved, that they don't necessarily care about their kids' education.
Oh, we know they do. We know they
do.
Oh, definitely.
I believe you were talking about whether families valued education.
Valuing education, that's different. Getting them in, I mean, I know that they care. Those are their children. They care.
Right.
But as far as the understanding of what an education can do,
right,
is the same as what it was in the 50s and 60s. I recently did some little research and finding out that with a high school degree, you earn $6,000 more. With a college degree, I've seen two different numbers, something like close to $1 million more over a lifetime.
Never liked that.
If you have a college degree. And getting an education, even a high school education,
mm-hmm,
is going to equate more money and being able to take care of yourself.
I think your emphasis on folks early on, mm-hmm, understanding the value of longer schooling is really important. I have a student right now who's studying a middle school in Washington, D.C., and the question she's asking is whether the school, along with the parents, is doing enough to orient the kids towards going to college. And it turns out the school is very much orienting the kids, it's a charter school, very much orienting the kids toward trying to select an academic high school in Washington, but it hasn't put much emphasis on college. It turns out that, in fact, unless kids really have a disposition for going to college, that they're working toward that, that they see themselves as somebody who's going to go to college, unless they have that by eighth grade, the likelihood of their actually going on is much, much less. So that's important.
Yes.
I think trying to find ways to actively involve parents is difficult, and you know that much better than I. You know it firsthand. At the same time, I would not want us to see. I would not want us to not find ways to teach kids well, even if for whatever reasons their parents aren't able to be involved. Some parents view schools kind of like hospitals. You know, you send your kid to the hospital, and you expect the doctor to be able to fix her. You yourself may not have been highly educated. You're struggling. You say the teachers are the ones who know. And as long as my kid is dressed well and is well-behaved, I've done my part. I think there have to be ways of engaging kids in developing their identity as students without expecting a great deal from the parents.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a definite. When I receive my children, that is every fall. It's these are my children, and granted, I work towards developing dialogue, and particularly if there's a child, be it academic or social, that I see they stand out for whatever reason, you want to have that dialogue going right away. But the need to set high standards, we've got the standards. Wisconsin provides the standards, and we teach to that. At least I would hope everyone is teaching to that. And so we, you know, I've got my master's. I've got good ideas, good strategies that meet my own personality and how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. You have to have the high standards. And when I went into K-4, it was my first time ever teaching K-4. I upped it before K-4 had standards at mm-hmm. our school. And based on what I knew from raising my own children, based on what I knew from having observed preschools, I knew that I was going to introduce it. And every year from that point on, you introduce those high standards. It may be over the head of some children, but you introduce it, and you keep going with those high standards so that many of them can reach it. Many of them can reach it. If they can't, then you're finding out, you're looking into why or why not. Even though there is a disparity, yes, they're coming in with a vocabulary that is 2 and 3 years behind.
Hmm.
You work on that too. You work because they can't learn to read without having no vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
So you definitely, you know, you have to set those high standards, or they're never going to reach their potential.
Could I ask one other question of the caller?
Sure.
What would make it possible for you to do your job better? What would either the state or the school system have to provide, or what kind of conditions might they ideally create that would make it more possible for you to take the dedication you have and make it actually work more productively? Hello?
I think that, well, I teach in a SAGE classroom.
Mm-hmm.
That allows for 15.
That's nice.
Per teacher. That's not the case in K-4 because it's funded differently. I had a class of 25,
mm-hmm.
one teacher and one aide. But if I could do anything, I would say I would keep the numbers down, and I would. I'd like to have another person. I'd like to have more volunteers providing a little more individual time to the children. At 5 years old, they still need a lot of attention. You don't think of there being a wide range, but I've got children who can read at a first grade level in K-5, and I have children who still do not know all of their sounds. And so I'd like to individualize more. But to do this, I need additional people. And we're losing our aides. We lost 2 aides this year.
Oh.
And we're losing that additional help. And I'd like to have more volunteers within our school. Yes, the funding, everybody is scared about the funding. We know it's going down with the choice and charter schools getting more of our students, which I have a potential of losing my top 3 students. One of them may go to a suburb school. The other 2 are going to MPS. But we are all concerned about the economics of budget, because now it's cutting into losing staff.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to keep our classroom sizes small. It would be nice if the 4th, 5th, and 6th as well. There's research about, well, of course, the high schools are trying to keep theirs small, and there's ways of differentiating and teaching to where your child is. And if we could get more people teaching to where the children are and not lumping them all together, that would be helpful too.
Sari, we need to move to some other phone calls. Thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jim from Wilson, Michigan is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. There's one thing I haven't heard a lot of talk about, and that's the attitude. Think of after the Vietnam War, there was a large influx of people from Asia. And these children not only had to learn English, they had to catch up with their age group. And going to the ghetto schools, they did better than Americans of all races. And I think they had a different attitude.
May I comment on that?
Yes, please.
I think they have more resources than just a different attitude, say, toward education. The communities of many of the communities of Asian immigrants have a great deal of what sociologists and economists call, in a fancy term, social capital. The stability of the communities, the connections among people in the communities, the tight-knitness of families, a larger number of entrepreneurs emerging in the community to provide supplementary education opportunities. There is something very different. Obviously, your caller is quite right that people similarly impoverished as long-term American minority groups, people as perhaps even more culturally remote from what the schools are asking, have indeed done better. It leads very naturally to the question of, well, if they can do it, why can't and why haven't others? I think the answer lies in some processes that are both complicated, historical, more social, in the way communities are structured, in the ways it's more possible to enforce norms and conformity to what's necessary to do well in school. And you add to that a kind of immigrant optimism that's based on comparing that very same ghetto school to what was not there in the past, or what was far worse, whereas for an African-American family who's generations in the ghetto, that very same school means something different, perhaps. That same school is still a segregated school that isn't being treated as well as the white school in the suburb. The contrast they're making may be very different. So, it wouldn't surprise me, it doesn't surprise me to see particular immigrant groups doing very well despite the kind of obstacles they face. Mm-hmm. But I think it needs to be appreciated that it's not simply a matter of attitude or valuing of schooling. It's also a matter of how kids get treated in the school. Different groups have historically experienced very different treatment in our schools. If you go back to the early 20th century and you study how very poor East European Jews were doing compared to Southern Italian kids, one and only one factor that keeps coming through is how much the teachers welcomed the Jewish kids, and how easily frustrated and dismissive of the Italian kids they became. I think, that there are ways in which, by their initial behavior, some immigrant groups' kids enjoy more support from the schools.
Thanks very much for the call. What about this talk, and it's involved in this gender issue very much. There have been some schools, and we did a show on this a few months ago, showing that maybe boys and girls get distracted by each other, and maybe one of the factors we need to think about as we look at equity, gender equity in education, and perhaps even it goes off, it go over in the area of income disparity, is to separate by gender. Does that factor at all, do you think, into this discussion that we're having, Professor Olnick?
I certainly know there are folks who think it does. I have to confess that the research on single-sex schools is not something I'm familiar with, other than knowing it exists. So I wouldn't want to say too very much. I do know that within the African-American community for some years there's been discussion of the ways in which schools are particularly ill-suited to helping African-American boys. And they've experimented with single-sex school or all-male schools, if not single-sex for the girls as well. A school in Detroit, Malcolm X Academy, comes to mind. I honestly think I'm best off just saying I'm not sure. Let it go at that.
Okay. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest is Professor Michael Olnick. He's professor of educational policy studies and sociology at the University of Wisconsin. And we're looking at this latest report from the American Association of University Women, which looks at trends in educational achievement by gender, race, ethnicity, and income. The report is titled, Where the Girls Are, the facts about gender equity in education. More calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, and Dave from Ann Arbor. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is regarding the No Child Left Behind Act, and I was wondering how the policies of it have either contributed to or helped combat against the disparity in academic success among different races.
Okay, good question.
What I've seen, and I'm relying here on a report by the Center for Educational Policy, I believe. I'm not sure of the source. There has been a group that's looked at this quite closely, and one of the things they find is that if you use as your measure some of the same measures that are in this AAUW report that we're talking about, namely the National Assessment of Educational Practice, National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a national test, if you look at that over time, since No Child Left Behind, there's been no improvement really in reading. Math has continued to improve at about the same rate as previously, and the racial gaps have remained pretty constant. There are some states in which using state tests of the kind of comparable, say, to what we have here in Wisconsin, that are showing diminishing disparities by race. I think that's because those tests are easier, they're not a particularly good indicator of really how well we're doing nationally, because the degree of difficulty in the test varies from state to state. The states with the easier tests show the greatest gains and the greatest amount of reducing the racial gaps. There are a lot of problems with No Child Left Behind that bear directly on this issue. One is something called the phenomena of the bubble kids. You know how in the NCAA tournaments we talk about teams on the bubble. These are teams that might fall into the tournament or might fall out of it. Well, what's happening in a lot of classrooms and schools now is, in the zeal to raise test scores to escape the sanctions of NCLB, teachers are focusing on the bubble kids, the kids who came close to passing the last time, or who other signs indicate they could pass. And they're putting their energy and their time into those kids, to the relative neglect of kids who are further back and who don't have a chance in the short run, of passing the tests. So, in a way, we're leaving behind the kids who are already furthest behind. Mm-hmm. Second thing I would say about No Child Left Behind is the amount of time, especially in inner city schools, that's being spent on test prep is rather enormous. Now, you could say, well, great, we're meant to teach to the test. We're meant to get the kids to learn the material that's on the test, and if they score higher, all to the good. That's not what test prep necessarily means. Test prep may just be drilling in skills or ways of figuring out how to raise your test score without necessarily knowing anymore. There comes a point at which the test is no longer a valid test of the universe of the curriculum and the knowledge people are meant to be gaining and the skills they're meant to be gaining. And there are some folks who think that at least in some places that's taken place. I think you have to ask, does No Child Left Behind speak to constructing effective pedagogic relationships between teachers and kids? Does it give the kids and the teachers the support they need? And No Child Left Behind is based on the idea of threats and sanctions. I don't think that's any way to improve education.
Thanks, Dee, very much for your call. Mary from Madison, hi.
Hello. I'm so enjoying the program. This wasn't what I called a say, but we spent many years living next to a Chinese family in the Bay Area, and I was just thunderstruck by how differently the children's lives unfolded that grew up next to us. The parents had shared one toilet and one stove burner in Chinatown with six other families. All the boys had gone into the service as soon as they could in order to learn a trade, and all the kids were selling newspapers on the street as soon as they understood how to make American change because the family needed the money. But we had three generations living in the house next to us. None of the women drove, and that was a point of great pride to the husbands because it was their job to take their wives where they needed to go. The television was off in that house five nights a week. The children had dinner, they took showers, and they sat down at their desks for 2 hours. The whole family raised the kids. They were all straight-A students. They were beautiful, happy kids. In one generation, all those kids had gotten scholarships or partial scholarships, most of them to Berkeley, as I recall, and they had graduate degrees in the hard sciences. And when we left, the parents were living in a beautiful home right on the bay, and everybody was doing well. And I never saw anything like the absolute dedication that they poured into those kids. And again, not in a rough, unkind way. As the father said, we didn't want them to hate us.
Mm-hmm.
But the expectations for the children were crystal clear. Everybody understood the entire family's future rested on the education of the young kids. And what a beautiful thing that was to watch. I've never seen anything like it. And my grandfather came to this country when he was a little boy, and I won't drag you through that story, but I often thought how that situation must have brought out the worst and the best in everybody.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I called to say was that I think there's a willful naivety, a blind spot about where we expect women to end up. And I thought your speaker might allude briefly to the study. It might have been at Radcliffe. It was one of the Seven Sisters colleges some years ago that did a study that found that most women that complete college or graduate degrees end up dropping out once they have families or they work part-time now and then. And indeed, that's been the experience of almost everybody I grew up with. It's most people move to the suburbs. It's overwhelming to try to deal with childcare and driving to all the activities. And I often wonder when I go to high school graduations for family members and hear all the girls get up and talk about how they're going to be astrophysicists and neurologists and on, how their chances of doing that are so slim. Most people want to marry and have families. And you can't do it. But this country continues to somehow behave as if it can be done, as if each individual woman can solve this problem. And I wondered what he might say. The problem is when you drop out for years to have kids, and there's nothing wrong with that, certainly, it's virtually impossible, as men have always understood, to get back in.
Professor Olnick.
Well, I think the caller is pointing exactly to where we have to look to understand gender disparities. It's not inside the classroom, per se. It's toward the division of labor that we expect to obtain in families. Everything she says is quite right. I tried to discuss this just the other day in a class I'm teaching in sociology, and we were talking about ways in which schools might put girls on a different track than boys. And this is an overwhelmingly female class. There was absolute unanimity that the future they're going to have is something they're going to choose. That the schools had not discriminated, the schools had not been biased. I kept asking them, well, are there things that happen in the schools that help create models of what people should want and should become that influence these choices in ways that could be different, possibly. And the young women were virtually unanimous in saying no, they were going to choose what they chose because it's what they wanted. And they do anticipate curtailing their career aspirations. Or not developing them in the same ways as men do. But they don't feel that this has anything to do with what the schools are making them do. But if you really want to address the issue of education and gender, the real question is, why do women do less with their educations than men do, not whether or not there's a trivial gap in some math scores on some math tests?
Yeah. I thought the figures were quite different about the number of women in the workforce, that most women in this country married with children are in the workforce, and most of them are in the workforce full time. I mean, there are some who go in part time or come in and out when they have children. But women are working now, aren't they?
Women are absolutely working, and they're working a lot. But what you just pointed to is important: taking time out, going into the labor force, coming out of it, raising kids, going back. You're not going to be able to simply put yourself back where you would have been had you stayed in the labor force longer. Are you taking jobs that don't require you to work ungodly hours in the professions, for example? Do you say, the hell with 80 billable hours per week? I really want to live a humane life and be with my kids. So I won't be a partner. I'll be an associate. And I'll write some briefs, but, you know, I'm not going to go for the whole prize.
Uh-huh.
Do you become a teacher not necessarily because you want to teach your subject or you love kids, but because you get out at 3 o'clock? These are all ways in which women can definitely be in the labor force and still not be capitalizing on their education. Now we're talking, though, about college-educated women. Millions upon millions of women in the labor force are high school graduates, and they are working low-paid jobs in which the kind of jobs they hold pay little for everyone.
Right.
Um, Can I say one thing about the comparison of the Chinese community?
Yeah, very quickly.
I know we're running out of time.
We only have about 15 seconds.
The advantage that Asian kids demonstrate in the immigrant generation disappears over generations. It's a distinctively immigrant thing, not Asian thing.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Olnick. Professor Michael Olnick, Professor of Educational Policy Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin, reacting to the AAUW report released last Tuesday that debunks the so-called boys' crisis in education. They say income disparity is more influential than gender in educational achievement, says this analysis. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for listening and for all of your calls on this Memorial Day. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 until 11, talking about interesting issues of the day. One of our hours on Nancy Pelosi. So stay tuned. Great conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.